You know which way to go. And if one of those controls run out of range, you'll say, aha, something changed. That vacuum variable ain't acting the same way as before inside of it because of the way it got hit with lightning or whatever. So you've got the instrumentation that's got the sensitivity that allows this sight-impaired person to walk up that hill there. You're at the foothills of this hill, and you want to know, do I go north or do I go south to go uphill? The spectrum analyzer is going to tell you. And when one of those tuning controls went out of range, you're going to say, aha, it's time to take it apart and find out what the hell happened in there. I'd love to hear what you finally find out. This is a we transmitter enthusiasts called ham radio operators. We just love broadcast transmitters. So take good notes, Eric, and give us all the dirty details of what you discover. K2EJ, K2LAW.
K2YL.
Very recognized. We've been looking for you. Eric first to finish off on this one. K2EJ, K2LAW. Alright, K2RW, K2J. There's no vacuum variables in this thing. It's, you know, it's a cavity. It's basically little plates that move in and out, so that's how they make the pi circuit in the end. I'll be back in about 15, 20 minutes, and I'll tell you what happened. Also, there's an interesting way this thing is made. Within the cavity, there's second harmonic suppressors, which is really nothing more than capacitors. It's a coaxial plate line which sits around the tube. The suppressor is just in the right place. You actually have to move it in and out. I'm assuming that if I get this far, I won't have to neutralize it. They say that neutralization is pretty stable even when you change tubes. But by the way, I put a soft tube in there. I don't have the good tube in there because I want to get myself in the right zone before I even attempt to put the good tube in there. K2RWK, pretty tight.
Spot move.
Good luck with that project. However, you gotta be a little bit careful. The soft tube, in its softness, may also tune differently and give you a couple of false alarms. In the worst case, the soft tube might actually knock something out of resonance, you know what I mean? So maybe you want to briefly plug in the good tube under very light conditions to see if resonance changes a whole lot. Bernie, I've been here telling that we're mesh-enabled, is what I've heard. And so we'd like to hear some details of that. Most of us don't know what the hell a mesh is. We know that you put a whole lot of work into a mesh. We know that you had the wrong size U-bolts to try to mount the antennas. And so it took multiple efforts of that. So apparently a heroic effort was required today. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW in the TechNet. Tell us about the field day coming up.
Hey, Bernie, did you drop that stuff off or not yet?
Not yet, Eric. I'll see you this week on that. Good evening, Dick and Ness. I can't say it's a heroic effort when I made the mistake and screwed up. So, if you make a problem, you can't really call it heroic effort. I guess the first question is, what is mesh? And basically, mesh is a type of network. And a lot of people don't realize that it's ham ability to operate from the 4G range where your wireless routers operate. So, go to HFMM, or actually just Google HFMM, you'll find that there's a ham radio effort to basically build our own network.
Bernie, you could give us 6 or 8 dB more audio. We're hearing you, but it's quite weak. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
That seems to be contagious tonight. I'll do what I can. I'm about all the radio has. But basically, the mesh project is the ability for hams to create their own private network in an emergency situation where maybe the internet's down. It sure would be handy if we could have our emergency operators have their own computer network in the background.
Bernie, are you talking into the back of that microphone? That's the way it sounds. Can you move that microphone closer to your mouth? Can you eat that mic? Even when you get a little bit of distortion, we'll at least hear more audio. Go ahead, Bernie. Maybe Bernie is changing the microphone. I hope I haven't made him unhappy with me.
sounds like you have it set on 2.5 kilohertz deviation instead of 5. That's a J unit.
You might be right, Joe. And as I'm hearing him with earphones, I know the characteristic sound of somebody talking into the back of a microphone. But I'm having trouble believing if that's what's happening.
Eric was talking about that broadcast transmitter. From my experience, it sounds like his APC circuitry that's supplying the voltage to the screen grid is not allowing the screen grid to get enough voltage on it to be able to tune it. Because if the screen grid voltage is too low, it doesn't matter what you have on the control grid, and you know you have voltage on the plate, that screen grid is going to block any plate current. So you can't even tune it then. You have to get enough voltage on the screen. Which, from what he was saying, he probably needs at least maybe close to 1,000 volts on that screen if it's 1,500 volt max. And without 1,000 volts on the screen, he's not going to be able to get enough plate current to, even with a low amount of drive, to be able to see any kind of power on the plate enough to be able to start tuning the cavity to be able to get resonance. It's pretty hard with that kind of setup to try to do it any other way. You have to have some plate current flowing in. If that power control circuit is damaged, it's not allowing the screen grid to put any voltage on the screen grid, you're never going to be able to tune it to the JQ.
Into the wire.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Joe. Bernie, let's see what your audio sounds like now. It sounds like you went and got another microphone. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW in the Tech Man.
They should get a different radio, different mic, and a non-subterranean radio. That's radio in the basement, so apparently it's failing at this point. Is this better?
Quite a bit better. Please proceed and repeat everything you've said up till now so that people can hear it.
Okay, so the first question is, what is mesh? And mesh is a type of networking where basically you can think of it like a cellular network where each individual low-power transmitter, there are many of them, they all butt up against each other and they all talk to each other in their own range. And this is what allows them to be able to send transmissions back and forth.
Okay, you've given us a couple words to...
So, in a world, don't realize, but as ham radio operators, we're allowed to operate on the same frequency as your home Wi-Fi router. They use 802.11. Channel 1 and channel 2 of the Wi-Fi range is within the ham radio frequency. Now, your home router can put out about 250 milliwatts and sleep in the antenna, whatever the ERP is for that. In our case, we're allowed, 1,500 watts and as much antenna as we want. And so there's the ability to put a much stronger signal than home Wi-Fi would. And so effectively what this does is allows you to take off-the-shelf routing equipment, hop it up, like you hop up a car and make it higher performance, and then that as a node to talk to other hams nearby you, and talk to ones nearby them, et cetera, et cetera. So this is still in a very infantile stage when you talk.
Get a little bit closer to that microphone. Get a little bit closer to that microphone now, Bernie.
Doing so. And so we're just getting started on Long Island with this. There's only about 10 or 15 nodes in existence. But Limark now has a node at our southern input, which basically covers a large swath of any meadow, so it covers a large swath of what I call the flats of Long Island. So this node went up and on the air today, and we had a couple of hiccups getting antennas mounted and all that kind of stuff. But it is on the air now, so anybody that has a mesh node that thinks they can reach meadow should definitely try to connect to it. And you'll be hearing more and more about this. We should have a demonstration going on at Field Day. Aries will be showing mesh connectivity and how they can utilize it for their emergency capability. So it's a very growing thing. It doesn't cost a lot to get into. Basically, if you get an old Linksys router, or if you get a Ubiquiti, one of the Ubiquiti routing devices, you can make a mesh node just by changing the software. Is that generally what you're looking for, Dick?
He's giving us some nice data. You might give us a couple of words now as to how you intend to use it during field day. I'm guessing we'll get some extra points, extra bands, extra frequencies, extra communication, messages being passed, things along these lines. You showed us the antenna Friday at noontime at the noon get-together in Melville, and that antenna looked to me like it was a zillion dB of gain, a very tall collinear antenna for the 2.4 gig band. As such, I'm guessing that antenna has a pancake pattern where the vertical beam width of that pancake pattern is only a couple of degrees. Lots of dB of gain on the horizon if the antenna is perpendicular to the ground. So in your opinion, Bernie, how close to straight up is that antenna? Is it to the nearest couple of degrees you'd like it to be? Because if the antenna was tilted to the east, then the guys at the east are going to see an antenna pattern that's into the ground. The guys to the west are going to see an antenna pattern that's above the ground. North and south will be fine. So you got to worry about the tilt of an antenna like that. That antenna could never be mounted on the top of the mast of a sailboat. K2 Yankee Oscar, get close enough to the mic, please. K2 RAW in the deck man.
What just saw on Friday, by the way, if there's any hams out in the Route 110 area, there's a kind of get-together lunch at 110 in the LIE. This is there on Friday. I brought one of these along to show and tell. Basically, it's an off-the-shelf device. It's the antenna's about 4 feet long. It's a 15 dB antenna at 3.4 gig. And it has an in connector on the end of it, and the Wi-Fi router actually has an in connector on the end of it, and so the Wi-Fi router was screwed to the bottom of the antenna. So literally, instead of coax running up the antenna mast, there's a piece of Cat5 cable with PoE, power over internet or over Ethernet on it, running up to power this thing. And so literally, the transmitter and all are at the top of the antenna mast. Check right now, the antenna is not as vertical as I would like. We're probably 2 to 3 degrees off of vertical, and this offends my anal retentivism. The mounting bracket is not sufficient, so I, in fact, the phone call I was just getting is the gentleman's going to fix the mounting bracket for me. So, TP, I'll be calling you back. But, yeah, it will be the, that basically we're going to fix the mounting bracket to make a little sturdier. The antenna only costs $60, so this goes back to you get what you pay for. But the idea is that it will be absolutely vertical when we get done.
And the fact that you told me the antenna has got 15 dB of gain, and I just did some quick back of the envelope mathematics on that, that suggests that this pancake pattern has a vertical beam width in the vicinity of 5 degrees total, plus or minus 2.5 degrees. If the verticalness of that antenna is 2.5 degrees wrong from being perfectly straight up, in that direction you're going to be 3 dB down in gain. Go to numbers like 5 and 6 degrees off to one side, and that beautiful beam width will be aimed into the ground in that direction. Nobody will hear anything. That gives you a little bit of an idea. The nice thing of having all that gain in a collinear antenna is that it's omnidirectional, and you don't have to aim it, and it's nice and simple. If everything is vertical. So I've now given you some rough ballpark figures as to how vertical that antenna's got to be. And so how potent a transmitter's going to be connected to it, what kind of communication do you think is going to take place during field day, which one of the 10 should we visit in order to see this in operation, are you going to be there? Tell us anything you want to, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW.
Take a while. The ubiquity of the manufacturer of the device I'm using, I believe its maximum power is 650 milliwatts. So that'll be going into the 15 dB. For field day, we're not exactly sure what we're going to be showing. We are attempting to get a live connection between our field day site and the Gizbarn field day site. And, right now, unfortunately, I've been hung up with some family problems, so I'm behind the curve on what I wanted to get done. But we'll be passing some kind of data. Unfortunately, this stuff is such cutting edge in ham radio. I don't believe field day acknowledges points on this. So we may not get any field day points after this, because The NRRL doesn't even quite have a sanctioned category for this. When you get to field day, Aries will be showing the communications trailer. It's a trailer with a number of antennas posted on it. Dave Akins is the owner of it. And you, when you see that, you'll notice that on the back of it will be a one of these omnidirectional antennas attached to it, and you'll be running a similar node. We're not sure if we can get omni-to-omni connectivity from the field day site to the hospital, but I also have a 23-gig dish that we may have to use the dish in the hospital, but that's also, this is, you know, right now we're still kind of experimenting our way through how are we going to use this as an investigation.
Very fine, Bernie. I think you said 650 milliwatts is the real output of the transmitter that's going to be connected to that antenna. That combined with 15 decibels of gain means your effective radiated power is 20.5 watts. So 20.5 watts and the number of miles between you and the Nassau County Medical Center, as long as you've got line of sight, that should work like a charm. However, what kind of terrain, trees, buildings, and whatever between you and NCMC. The good news of NCMC is I think it's a 22-story building. I'm guessing it's within 15 or 20 miles. Sounds like that should be a pretty solid communication link. What do you think? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW.
There's a website that actually will let you plot your range and put it on a map, put your transmitter, your height, and all these things. That should definitely be doable. I believe that we are at 2800, I calculated. The medical center is a registered FCC antenna site, and so their document basically saying it's rated elevation above sea level and then the elevation of the antenna platform. And so I believe this is 280 feet. So, yes, definitely it's high up. A lot of people have line of sight to it. So this, we're hoping that this is something that will start keeping a lot of our Landmark members that will be interested in this project. Mesh is one of those things that it will only work if a large number of people decide to get involved. Your cost is anywhere from $5 to, I think, about $120 on equipment to set up in the air. And so everybody that can get one of these up in the air, it makes it more and more successful and gets us more and more routing up.
If Bob is listening, I still see evidence that the Eastern Link, 147.375, seems to not be on the air. So the guys on Eastern Long Island are not hearing us, unfortunately. This is the valuable information that Bernie's giving us. What kind of information do you think is likely to be flowing over the mesh network as it gets established? Audio, data, video, broad bandwidth, narrow bandwidth, all of the above, because the amateur allocation on the 2.4 gig band allows us to run 1,500 watts of output. And right now you're running a fraction of a watt QRP because of the available equipment. And at some later time you could put an afterburner on that and it'd be a hell of a lot more potent. And it sounds to me like off-the-shelf equipment, not very expensive, so as long as we build up the enthusiasm, talking other people into it is not going to empty their wallet. And as such, this can become a very nice high-speed network for transmitting data, particularly during fox hunts and things like that. I see all kinds of applications here, Bernie. So what kind of data would you be transmitting at first, and ultimately what kind of data can it do? Everything. What can it not do? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW.
WB2OMW.
Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks, Dick. I know I wasn't able to reset it, so it's quite possible it might require a field visit or a drone strike, whichever comes first.
NKC2YDT.
Matt, you got information on this one? Go right ahead.
Just to let everyone know, too, getting very good modulation today. I'm out in Manorville right now, and I'm talking on the Western Link. So very possible people in the eastern area can just go to 850 and listen in and talk that way.
Okay, good to know, Matt. So the propagation gods are favoring us tonight, and the 8-5 signal is getting out there to eastern Long Island. If those guys are smart enough to listen to 8-5, some of those guys out there think the only way they can talk is on 375. If they're listening to 375 and there's nothing there, they probably go to sleep or go watch television. They don't know to go to 8-5. So the link, we don't have the link to tell them. Maybe somehow by some means, by telephone chain, we can tell them, hey, don't give up and go to 8-5. Thank you, Matt. So, Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, tell us anything you want to as to what kind of data and how much of an investment does it take for an enthusiastic, progressive guy to get into the mesh ballpark. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RAW, and the TechNet.
Well, your question is a very interesting one because it's both high-volume data and low-volume data. On a simplistic way, this network is a standard IP network, so it's nothing different than the kind of network you would have at work or in your home as a data network. You could run an email server on it. Suddenly now all the ARRI-served locations now have email addresses. And you can get email over that, and this email does not go on the internet. We're not talking about an internet right now. Let's assume that it's not internet connected, and so it would be a giant private network that happens to have email on it. You could set up webcams. If it's an antenna out in Dix Hills, you could put a webcam on his backyard, and then all of us out in western Nassau and Queens, you can't get out there, could then pull up a web browser and watch it taking an antenna in his backyard. So that would be a high volume application. The throughput, I'm not actually sure what kind of throughput we're going to get. I believe it's going to be in the 20 megahertz range, or megabit range. So it will be as fast as your broadband cable is at home, and you will have that kind of throughput. So the thoughts are kind of limitless. Nick, you hit on one I haven't even thought of yet. So, yeah, we could be running mobile units doing transmitter hunting. Put an extra antenna on your, put a Wi-Fi antenna on the roof of your vehicle, and you could then be collecting, you'd be bouncing from node to node to node, collecting all, collecting whatever data was being sent to you. So, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of applications, and I'll be honest with you, I think most of them haven't even been really thought through yet. The cost, let me drop in the other cost. The cost to play in this could be as inexpensive if you've got a Linksys router under a bed somewhere. Pull that thing out, blow the dust off, get a power supply for it, put it on the air, get it up in the, reflash the firmware, put it up in the air, and you're set. So, depending on your handiness, you can build your own in many cases. The opposite end of that spectrum is you go to Amazon, you order three parts, and bang, you're up and flying. I went to Amazon because I needed something that would work at a commercial site. So I went to Amazon, I bought a Ubiquiti router, I bought a TPT antenna that you saw, and a PoE device. Got the shielded Cat5 cable, and bang, you've got a node. I think my investment was $135. So for $135, you have a completely off-the-shelf solution. As cheap as you can get it, you can build your own.
KQLR with a question.
Go right ahead, Kay. And I've got a question for him, too. You got it, Kay.
Thank you. Hi, this is Kay. KQLR. Bernie, you said a connection to the mesh could watch this theoretical webcam. Would somebody with any old internet access also be able to access our network and watch a webcam?
Thank you, Wyo. The answer is yes and no. Power level, so they can't. Wi-Fi router? No, that mesh does. I'm gonna just say that they're two different languages. Network and routing properties. So, no, they would not be.
I'm pretty sure Bob and Eric are monitoring all this. That undesired signal that was jamming Bernie is S3 at my location. But I would like all you guys to do, when you hear that jamming going on, go to the reverse mode on your receiver, transceiver, listen to how strong the signal is on the input, and please report it to Limark, RFI at Limark.org, RFI at Limark.org, and tell us how strong it was, what time you heard it, and where you were located at the time. So you might have to repeat portions of that, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
No problem. Kate's question was, could anybody get in and watch what's going on the ham mesh network? And the answer is no. So you have to have a mesh node to be able to do it. Now, there are some non-ham radio mesh nodes that may be compatible. And if you had one of those, then I'm going to say maybe, I don't know. But as a general concept, anybody with a Wi-Fi router will not be able to join one of these networks. You must have
Thank you so much, Bernie. This is AT2LR, back to you, Dick.
The unique thing about that antenna you showed us is I believe you said the actual router transmitter was built into the base of that antenna. Once again, what you guys are hearing, please go to the reverse mode. Tell us how strong it is, where you were located, what time you heard it, and report that to RFI at Limark.org. This individual really is persnickety, as you can tell. He's a sad person. The transmitter, I think, was built into the base of that antenna. That makes it very handy, because under normal circumstances, a 2.4 gig signal, if you're trying to put it on top of a 50-foot high tower, and you got to go through 50 feet of transmission line, that's going to give you a hell of a lot of loss. That's because the transmitter is built right into the antenna, and you're feeding it with power over Ethernet, that problem goes away, and the insertion loss of the cable becomes almost irrelevant. That's a very nice design of a system, communication-wise. The only slight problem with that is I think the antenna becomes a little bit more expensive. You might want to give us a couple of words on that. And as long as you've got a little higher power, you could go to Bernie. For this particular individual, that would help. Once again, if you guys are hearing these undesired signals on the input, which are going on and off right now, go to the reverse mode, tell us how strong it is. Please report it to RFI at Limark.org. Thank you, Yankee Oscar. Thank you, RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, the transmitter actually is separate from the connector. The transmitter. So they screw together and go up to one of my feed lines. Literally the length of it. I think I was able to wrap two pieces of this around. It's got two widths of it to cover the whole catch.
He's S9 out here in Port Zeb Station, NY2H.
Impressive. Yeah, I can tell he's in the Suffolk County area by at least how strong I'm hearing him on the input. And so when Bob and Eric make various changes to the system as he transmits, I think we can get some control over this. Very sad that this many years downrange we still have this particular problem. You may have said it, and I may have missed it, Bernie. What's the approximate cost of that antenna in that form? And I guess a person could use a more... the fact that the transmitter is built into the base of the antenna increases the price of the transmitter a little bit, but because of mass production, maybe I'm worried unnecessarily. If a person bought a... once again, that's S3 at my house. If a person bought a less expensive antenna that didn't have the transmitter built into the base of it and set it with ordinary transmission lines, they'd be able to get away with that if the transmission is short. At 2.4 gigs, you do have to worry about insertion loss. I can hear sounds in the background in the room of the person who's doing the jamming. That's a fixed station. What I'm getting at is the Is there a difference in... Is there a difference in the prices of the antennas we can buy with and without the transmitter located? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW. I can hear you on the input, Bernie, and I'll repeat it.
Affirmative. That's a 15 dB antenna. They make 8 dB. They make, I believe, an even shorter one, which would probably be down to the 3 to 4 range. So you can pick different sizes as you want, or you can actually go up even higher, at which point they become actually directional. I picked that Omni because that was the highest one I could get out of the Omni. And that really didn't sweat the cost too much.
Okay, you may have said it. So what is the approximate cost of the antenna in the form that you showed it to us Friday afternoon? And is there a less expensive form that doesn't have the transmitter built into the base of it? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW.
No. The antenna that I showed you does not have the transmitter built into the base of it. I had attached the transmitter. The transmitter is designed to attach the antenna. And the transmitter is designed specifically to screw to the base of the antenna. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad you cleaned that up for me, because you did point out to us that the transmitter is in the base. I thought you purchased it that way. You assembled it that way. I should have asked you more questions Friday afternoon. Beautiful setup. Now, because we amateurs, for a zillion years, have had access to the 2.4 gig band at roughly a kilowatt or 1,500 watts of output, so for years, the transmitting capability was there. The authorization for the FCC for hams to do it have been there. It sounds like a great idea. From one point of view, this is very progressive, and we're starting to get into something that's very exciting. From the other point of view, why did we wait so long? How did we suddenly find out about this, Eric? I mean, Bernie. Why? Once again, S3 on my input. Well, why did we wait this long, Bernie? Did you Yankee Oscar? Did you...
Well, this has been building for a while. About a year, maybe 2 months ago, there was an article in, I think it was USC, about the guys out west. Really, what Sega's the longest is guys that are much better programmers than me had to write the software, had to write the firmware to do this. So this has been building, and what we're seeing now is just that it's starting to gain critical mass. There's probably six or eight guys out of Gizmark that are doing this. There's three or four of us here in Limark that are starting to do it. So we're all just kind of talking this up and saying, hey, this is a cool idea. To computer geeks like myself, this is an ability that once we get this network up and running, then it's a standard network. And so all kinds of computer applications run over this.
Once again, Bernie, what issue of what magazine did you recently read about this concept? Over to you, Bernie.
Negative. It was at least a year ago in QSC. It was some type of a race out in the desert, probably Arizona, western Texas, maybe New Mexico, and they were using the mesh design to be able to get video back to the race planning people.
WS2N. Go ahead, Paul.
Found a reference to this type of network in a book called Cyberstorm that I read a few years ago. And they were, all the computer networks went out, and this one guy, his name was Vince, and he started this thing up. They called it the VinceNet. But it was the same type of thing. As long as you had more and more people in the area throughout, they were in New York City, as everybody got more and more of these things, they created their own little internet, a little wireless internet, and it just eventually spread through that, you know, throughout the whole state and everything. But that's the first reference I've had. That's what this sounds like, something like that. I wonder if you ever read that book, Cyberstorm, or even heard of it. Right. Back to you, Dick W.S.
Okay, no, the book Cyberstorm is a new one on me. Bernie, you referred to an article of a race that took place in California roughly a year ago, reported in QST Magazine. So, you remember the name of the article, and if a person looks back in QST in the archives roughly a year ago, what does he look for to pin down the available information in QST on this concept? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
Took 1 second, I found it. They actually called it the MeshNet in this book, back to you.
Okay, in that book they call it MeshNet, but in QST, you know, what do I look for roughly a year ago in QST, if you happen to know, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
Nah, no clue. I read it a year and a half ago. I don't remember. I just remember the general concept of it, and I've had other people mention how they had read the same article. The concept of mesh networking is used in a couple of different areas. Basically, it's the ability to get a network up without having to run wires. And so a lot of home applications do this kind of thing. There's a number of different companies that are working on this. There's also a concept of crowdsourced mesh networking, that if you've got a crowd of people and some population or some percentage of them have small nodes, small low-power nodes, actually networking among them all. So there are definitely some commercial applications.
Although this could be pretty far off to one side, is there any relationship between Bluetooth or any of these other short-range networking wireless systems and the mesh that you're now discussing? Any relationship there at all, Bernie? Go ahead.
I'm going to say no. The topology is much more like how a cellular network is laid out, where you have a bunch of small diameter nodes that overlap. I right now I'm having difficulty drawing any kind of analogy.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. When will you be giving us our next report? I'm guessing you're going to be doing some experimenting this week to make sure it's operational for field day operation next weekend. And I think I heard tell that you guys are going to be very careful where you put the stakes to make sure you don't hit any of the sprinkler system tubing that's in the ground. Is that roughly true, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LAW.
Well, having driven a finish nail through a heating pipe in my house, I can tell you it's a bad idea to puncture plumbing with stakes. But no, I'm not involved in that part. But if anybody wants to hang out for a real cool technical conversation, shall we say, TechNet Light will be happening Saturday night, probably about 9, 10 o'clock at field day. And I'll be getting there probably about 8 or 9 o'clock or so. I'll be working overnight crew as an operator. But yeah, we should have some definite stories to talk about at field day in the early evening about it.
In a couple of past years, as I visit my three favorite field day sites, I quite often end up at Limock, 11 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, crazy times. And I usually stay with those guys until the sun rises. And then I go back to my college days where doing an all-nighter, doing a study for a test coming up. The philosophy we used to have in the college I went to is that every time the sun rises, you got to change your socks. Okay. Good luck with that operation, Bernie. I know we got way off to one side, John, but get us back on track. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I'll try it. KC2WGB. Okay, now to finish up on Lexan and Glass. You can assume that the transmissivity of the two will be equal in that frequency range from what you said. Is that correct? That's what he's asking.
Yeah, the dielectric constant of Lexan and polycarbonate and plexiglass is fairly similar. And at 10 gigs, because they have rather similar dielectric constant, the next big variable is how many wavelengths thick is it? if it's like a tenth of a wavelength thick, no fin, so-called thin skin, ray dome-like design, it's almost not there. You start approaching, the worst case is, it's in the velocity factor of the glass. And by the way, once you know the dielectric constant of something, you take the square root of it, divide it into one. That is your new velocity factor. And if your velocity factor came out to be 0.5, because it was a 4-to-1 dielectric constant, square root of 4 is 2, divide 2 into 1, you get 0.5. So you would have half the speed of velocity in a dielectric material that has a dielectric of 4. Therefore, a quarter inch of material would really be electronically a half inch. And at 10 gigs, where the wavelength is roughly 1 inch, a quarter inch of material is the worst case. A quarter wavelength of material is going to give you the biggest reflection. Half wavelength of material goes back to the non-inversion. Quarter wavelength of transmission line, whether it be in air or a coax cable, doesn't matter. This stuff is in air. Quarter wavelength gives you impedance inversion. Half wavelength gives you impedance equal. So exactly a half wavelength electronically when you drop. If your plexiglass or Lexan is exactly a half wavelength thick, then all of a sudden it becomes transparent again. Every even number of half wavelengths is transparent. Every odd number of quarter wavelengths, even number of quarter wavelengths, transparency. Odd number of quarter wavelengths, maximum reflection. Because as the glass is, as far as the glass is concerned, there's a nearly open circuit on the far side. Therefore, the nearly open circuit becomes a short circuit on the near side. And therefore, you get maximum reflection. So, even before you add quarter wave coupling plates, the thickness of the glass is probably the biggest variable. Ain't that crazy, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, it is wild. And anybody who has a satellite TV antenna, if they look at it, and are able to get near the horn, that receiving horn, if you look at that plastic lens, that's exactly what you're talking about. And you can see the way that is shaped, and it's extremely thin. Doesn't stand up too well in ultraviolet also. Okay, I just have one more that came over the chat room, which I have to present from Ed. Let me let it drop. Okay, Ed, KP2, Alpha Delta Charlie, he's asking a question about a product he's seen recently on TV. Believe it's a new product. It's an LCD type of device. It's a flat panel antenna. He's asking if anybody has any information. It's a satellite type antenna, and it has directivity. That is LCD technology, and it has directivity. Has anybody heard of it? And can you give an idea how that works? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, the usual satellite dish, they call it KU band, but it's really just a little bit above the 10 gig ham band. And that radome that's over the feed horn on a satellite dish, the 18-inch diameter offset fed parabolic dish that's very popular. And there's something like, I forget the exact number, I think it's like 15 million of them. Used in the United States right now, and that was designed by a ham radio operator, all of a sudden I've forgotten his name and call letters, who worked for RCA Astro in Princeton, New Jersey, and about 20 or so years ago is when he did that design, and a very popular design, it's been repeated millions of times in the United States, and on the surplus market, the guys on 10 gigs can buy that antenna for numbers like $20. Boy, they get a lot of performance out of that. And yes, that radome over that feed horn has got a thin piece of plastic, which is the so-called thin skin design, less than a tenth of a wavelength, therefore it's essentially completely transparent. Now, when it comes to flat-type antennas, there's a whole series of so-called slotted waveguide array-type antennas. phased array antennas. You said liquid crystal, LCD, and I'm having trouble believing that. LCD is an optical technique, and can you apply that to the 10 gigahertz band? I've got a problem with that one. But when it comes to taking a whole bunch of individual dipoles, each dipole on 10 gigs, before you increase velocity, increase velocity factor, let me drop. Because the wavelength on 10 gigs is very close to 1 inch. Each half-wave dipole is roughly half an inch, tip-to-tip, on 10 gigahertz. Before you start adding dielectric constants of the nearby material to make it a little bit smaller yet, like a velocity factor. So you could put a whole series of half-inch long dipoles by printed circuit technique. You can print a zillion of them on one sheet of, let's call it FR4 board, but printed circuit board. And you might at 10 gigs want to use a slightly higher Teflon glass type board, but it would work with FR4, and it's been done. WA5EJV, Kent Britton, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo.com. Go to his website. He has various kinds of phased array antennas on frequencies like that, which can give you as much gain as you want, as long as you dedicate the real estate on the antenna. If somebody shows you a horn on some frequency, and you find out the horn is, let me pick a number, 10 inches wide, you know that the horn is going to operate on 10 gigahertz, where the wavelength is 1 inch. Therefore, 10 inches wide, 1 inch wavelength, you know that the horn is 10 wavelengths wide. Okay? The magic number is 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths. 10 wavelengths divided into 70 degrees, the number is 7. Now know that that horn has 7 degrees of beam width by that simple calculation. Oh, it's got 10% error to it. Close enough. Tells you where the ballpark is. So if it's a dish that's properly being used, and you measure the number of wavelengths of the dish, if it's a horn, you measure the number of wavelengths of width of the horn. If it's a phased array antenna, in other words, it's a flat piece of printed circuit board with a whole bunch of little dipoles in there, all being fed with strip line light technique, all on this monolithic piece of printed circuit board, you find out how many inches wide, how many wavelengths wide, how many wavelengths high. Divide that into 70 degrees, you now know the beam width. Take the horizontal beam width, multiply it by the vertical beam width. Divide that into 30,000 degrees, you now know the gain. Take 10 times the log of that, you know the gain in decibels. As you can tell, in all cases, it's real estate. Let me drop. You tell me how much real estate there is on the throat of that horn. You tell me how much real estate there is across the surface of that parabolic dish. You tell me how much real estate there is in that flat phased array antenna of yours, that flat plate antenna of yours. And now, with reasonable accuracy, you can predict the beam width and you can predict the gain. It's not rocket science. The way they teach antenna design in our schools is almost a crime. The simple rules of thumb that all the seasoned antenna engineers who have 10 years of apprenticeship, this is how they're doing it. They don't go to Maxwell's equations. They're not manipulating three-dimensional matrix equations in order to design an antenna. Those great big equations, you think they're going to fill up a board with those, and all of a sudden they're going to say, aha, I'm going to build that antenna? No way in hell. They've got a bunch of rules of thumb that they use day in and day out, that they were taught by their mentor, and that's how they do it. And you're hearing some of that information right now. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
KC2GSQ, break.
GSQ, please start off with your name and to tell us your information.
How you doing? This is KC2GSQ. My name is Anthony. I'm in Rosneck, Bronx. I'm quickly referring to the article that Valerie was talking about in USP. I believe it was the July 2013 issue, and it was pages 68 and 69, where they were talking about HSMM-mesh router. And they talked about, in Texas, the rate to transmit video with a one-hop stream.
Darn good information, Barry. So I think you're saying Bernie, K2YO, was telling us that there is an article. You found the article, July 2013, QST, page 85 or page 68 and 69. Did I get that correct, Anthony? K2GSQ, K2LIW.
Yes, that would be page 68 and 69. I did a quick Google, and I'm reading in a forum about the article. But I'm going to look up the actual issue myself. But they talk here about the Texas crew that did a 10-mile link with at least one hop stream of video to the finish line of a race.
Well done, Anthony. Thank you for giving us that information. I do recommend in the future, though, Andy, when you want to add information, when you say, I've got info, you got to be a little careful with the word break, B-R-E-A-K. It is a word that we reserve for emergency situations on this, among other repeaters. So if life and limb is at risk, you use that word. Other than that, we restrict that word. So apparently no one has told you that. Don't worry. We'll forgive you this time. Be a little bit careful with that word. That's a dangerous word, if you know what I mean. Thank you. John, KC2WGB. So the word LCD type antenna, I'm a little bit confused by that one. And by the way, once you start building antennas on a flat plate, you're feeding them all with a whole bunch of little dipoles or similar step and repeat elements that are the radiators, that's a whole lot of them. That's one way of doing it. There are other ways with printed circuit antennas that are a little bit more elaborate, where you can emulate a parabolic surface, even though it's flat. Just don't tuck it into the back of your brain, it's there. And I got to put onto the website, one of the Mike and Mike websites, the fact that there's an article showing you a beautiful illustration as to how that's done. You'll be amazed what kind of magic you can do with printed circuit boards on microwave antennas. KC2WGB, KQLIW on the deck, man.
Very good, Dave. Yeah, it sounds sort of similar to a bed spring. But the directivity surprised me. But yeah, sounds interesting. Ed had a question on that, so at least he has a good idea if we can track down some more info. We have Paul with the space report to go yet, and Wesley next. We've had an issue. So we'll end it now with his mailbag and turn it back to you, Dick. And thank you, KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. Keep up the good work. And I'm amazed you can keep that many balls in the air watching all those computer programs. I'm busy as it is. I didn't volunteer for that one. Paul, sorry, we kept you waiting so long. And what's NASA doing now? I know I read an article this week that I wanted to bring to your attention about one or two other space probes, either European or American, that have recently been launched that are doing some great work out there. We now have got the total number of exoplanets that we've discovered, planets going around other stars. I think it's starting to climb at some very high numbers. We used to think that a planet going around a star was one in a million. Now we're suddenly discovering, that almost every star has planets. By the way, the good news is I'm hearing that it's off again. I was hearing a signal coming out of the 975-375. Oh well, it's off again. We discovered that almost every single star has got planets, and many of those stars have got a whole lot of planets just like our solar system. Not many of them are in the Goldilocks now. So we used to think that finding a planet was going to be very hard. So all of a sudden it became easy. Now we're getting persnickety. Now we want the planets we find to be just the right size. It's a little bit difficult because of the methods we're using. And we want them into the Goldilocks zone, just the right range from the star, so that liquid water is likely to be there, so that life as we know it can be formed. And by way of the Stanley Miller experiment, 1956, I think it was at Stanford University, or was it the California Institute of Technology, anyhow, he discovered you take the right raw materials, put them into a flask, put it in the right conditions, like lightning flowing through air, and the amino acids come out automatically. Mother Nature will form life for you every time. Appears to be the answer to that. So there's reason to believe that the right conditions, wait long enough, you'll always get life. There's good reason to believe that's true. And as such, if you read any of the articles recently about this very unacceptable article in the past, when Frank Drake, let me drop it. When Fry Drake first wrote his equation in the early 60s, predicting how much life is going to be out there, and he started a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because the National Radio Astronomy Observatory had just put up this 85-foot dish, and he talked the manufacturer into putting the dish in operation a month and a half ahead of time. And during that month and a half, he searched a couple of nearby stars to see if he could see any radio signals coming from the planets going around those stars. And people ridiculed the hell out of him. Why in the world are you wasting your time doing extraterrestrial, search for extraterrestrial, search for silly intelligence, as they gave him. They gave him a lot of flack. Why are you wasting time? Don't you realize that we're the only life there is? My goodness, was there arrogance. There were articles in the New York Times that said that. So we slowly come around from radio astronomy is crazy, and search for extraterrestrial intelligence is crazy, and search for planets going around stars is crazy. And all of a sudden, we give Nobel Prize for people who do that, and all of a sudden it's become acceptable. And by the same token, anybody who used to discuss the search for flying saucers and UFOs, some very qualified people, have seen things that are very difficult to explain by any other means. You start listening to some of those articles by some of these people making deathbed declarations, particularly the 600 people that have been interviewed in Roswell, New Mexico, describing what happened there on July 4th, 1947. A lot of those people were ridiculed like crazy in the past. And all of a sudden, you're suddenly realizing, whoa, there's a story here. And if you think we're the only life around and that nobody has wasted their time visiting us, that was the attitude until very recently. Let me drop it.
Many of those people were threatened, Dick.
Almost all of them. The U.S. government was scared to death. We didn't know where the hell that hardware came from. We were in the middle of the Cold War. In the beginning, they thought that was Soviet-built hardware, and they were scared to death that it represented something that represented a real threat to our national security. So they really clamped down on that until they did enough reverse engineering. And even then, they wanted to keep what they found out a pretty secret. So we're slowly finding out that all these very unacceptable subjects are suddenly becoming acceptable. And the crazy attitude that why in the world would anybody want to visit us for a damn good reason? If you have any interest in making a technological progress in your society, where does that come from? Answer is curiosity. If you've got curiosity, you want to know everything. You want to know what a molecule looks like. You want to know what every insect looks like. You want to know how an ant colony works, how a bee colony works, how all the animals work on your planet. You want to know what kind of life is on other planets. Are we a petri dish that where the stuff has been planted here, or are we just another interesting experiment that they can visit? If they've got the curiosity, they're going to come here. So to think that they wouldn't possibly visit us, the distance is too great, they couldn't get here, and we're not interesting. Well, those attitudes are slowly crumbling, and we're finding out there's a lot more involved here. I know I'm way off to one side, but back to you, Paul. WS2N, what is NASA doing? Because NASA is slowly getting into all of the above. WS2N, K2LAW.
It sounds like a version of the Fermi paradox here, I'm gonna go with they're not visiting me anytime soon. NASA is doing very good work, of course, with the space station. Not only theirs, the Russians, and 16 other countries, but this $100 billion project collectively, you know, with all the countries, is doing well. Plenty of science coming off it. Off of it, you have a crew of six. Russians just did a spacewalk a couple of days ago. Got two guys outside. They never did a spacewalk, both of them. They were brand new at this. Although they've been on the space station for 3 months, at a time, you know, instead of a 6-hour spacewalk, it turned out to be 7.5. They got themselves tired. They were told to rest quite a few times. It's not easy. Drop it. Collectively, between the Quest module, that's the one that they use, the United States uses airlock, and then here's airlock for the Russians. They've come up with over 180 spacewalks so far on the building of the